You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
702 and Cape Talk. The Literature Corner.
And this week, joined in studio, in fact, we'll be discussing two books this week. And the first one is a new book called Misbehave by Malebo Sepodi, new author, young author, having been published by Blackbird, one of my favorite publishing houses, an imprint of Chakana. And Malebo joins us in studio this morning. Good morning, Malebo.
Good morning, Gooks. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
I'm not so young.
I mean, okay, so according to the AU Charter, youth is between 16 and I think is it 35?
Okay, I'm almost there.
So you're still young.
I don't feel young.
And if you're Colin Miner, you might extend your youth a little bit further.
I'm 32.8.
So you're young.
Old.
Still young. So I've just noticed, is that a stack of books or a book as a tattoo on your left shoulder?
It's a book. It's just a book. An open book.
Uh-huh. No, a blank book.
Blank book, meaning it's corny. You know, your life is a blank page.
Aren't all tattoos? I have four of them.
Yeah.
And the truth is, in many ways, tattoos are very corny.
Exactly.
The whole process of thinking up something, wanting something on your skin permanently.
But it looks really good, don't you think?
I think it's really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you get this before you published, as you were writing? When did the tattoo happen?
The tattoo happened because I'm an avid reader. I love books and I love supporting local authors. Mm-hmm. And so I got it a few years ago, actually, before I wrote Misbehave.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so the reason I got the tattoo was just to symbolize the fact that we all need to read and books send us to a different world.
They really do.
Yeah.
It sounds cliche, but they do.
Listen, the best things of our lives are cliche.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's actually very true.
Yeah.
But why do you love reading so much? So much so that you got a book on your shoulder blade as a tattoo. Well, on your arm as a tattoo.
Because books have been very important in my life. I have a condition called ADHD.
So
it means... okay, I've been diagnosed. A lot of people claim ADHD.
No, I've been diagnosed when I was a child.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
It's not fun.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean you can...
You know, a lot of people claim, and I'm like, if you knew what you were claiming. But anyway, so books have been one of the major therapy that I use in order to keep my mind focused, because I struggle to focus. So because books saved my life, literally, I became really close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it's really exciting to hear different stories from different mediums, if I have to say that. And I enjoy supporting local authors, especially local women.
Mm.
When I say local, I extend it as far as the continent. So
local,
yeah.
Meaning
so I'm very obsessed. Africa. I'm also obsessed with the idea of having this huge library.
Mm.
You know, so I collect books. I mean, I have a whole stack of books, probably 300 books that I haven't read.
Mm-hmm.
So if you come to my library, you'll be envious, because I buy more books than I do shoes and lipstick.
So your thing is books.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And which book was your gateway book? Which one was the one that you picked up and it was the one that got you hooked? Or the one, and maybe it wasn't the first one, but the most impactful one that you remember.
That I remember. Well, it has to be Eskia Mphahlele's Down 2nd Avenue. Down 7th Avenue, right? And the reason why, it's because it's a book that I was gifted when I was a very young girl, and I've read throughout my life. I continuously read it. And because I have ADHD, I forget a lot. So I constantly have to read books to remind myself. And that's one of the books that I don't forget, and which is really important for me. So that was kind of my gateway book. I also like, I know this is also corny, No Violet Bulawayo. we need new names. And specifically because of a line in her book where she talks about how when black people speak English, the process that takes place, that when English is not your first language, it goes into your brain and you put the sentence together, and then as it comes out like a train smash, you know? And
yes.
I think that's the line that got me hooked. I love that book purely. You know when you love an album because of one song?
Mm-hmm.
I love No Violet Bulawayo's book because of that line. Yeah.
Because it's so apt.
Yeah.
She's right.
She explains things.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. And again, I mean, so we've established, what did you say? The best things in life are cliches
or
corny. I mean, you know, that makes sense.
We survive over
COVID. Also, someone just told me it's Thursday, not Wednesday. Apologies, I'm a day behind. It is Thursday, not Wednesday. I've been saying Wednesday all morning. But okay, so then books are your life. Books are, well, not your life, but they are hugely important.
Yeah.
And I understand what you mean by, you know, they almost help you remember things. They help you. I know books help me sit still because I struggle to sit still because of the ADHD.
Yeah.
So when do you decide that more than just wanting to consume them and be lost in them, you want to write them? And considering how, and did you know, I've just finished a manuscript.
Yay. Oh. I know.
And writing books is hard.
Publisher.
Writing books is hard, right? It's a painful, alienating, just it's a miserable process.
Yes.
When you decide you want to write, did you know that it would be that meh? It's not sexy, right? It's not sexy.
No, it's not. And actually, I have a different story because I've never considered myself as a writer. You know, simply because I've always thought that there are better writers than me out there. But I've always sparked a conversation on Facebook and people have always said to me, you're such a brilliant writer, only because I write in very simple English. Like, mm-hmm. if you read my work, you hear my voice.
Mm.
I write academic writing in my capacity as an academic, but in a social capacity, I write very accessible text. So people like that, the fact that I can take very complex scenarios and explain them in a simple way. And so I've always been told, Malebo, you need to write a book, but I've never thought that I had it in me to write a book. And then last year, I was sitting in a panel, actually Prof. Pumla Gola's book launch, mm-hmm. Rape.
She's so fantastic.
Yeah, she is. I was on her panel, and that's when Tabiso spotted me. You know, she found me, you know, like when scouts go to the field. And then afterwards, she's like, can we talk possibilities? And she liked how I presented the work that I did at Prof's book launch. Mm. And she asked me, she said, do you have any manuscripts lying around?
Just by chance.
And I was like, actually, no. And then she's like, if you were to write a book, what would you write a book about?
Mm.
And I was like, you know what? I would write a book about my journey as a feminist.
Uh-huh.
My journey with feminism. My journey as a black woman trying to find her autonomy. And she mm-hmm. said, perfect. That's exactly what I want. And she's like, when can you write it by? I was like, 2 months.
Listen. Although I made that mistake when I was initially asked to produce a manuscript. I said, I'll have it done in 3 months.
Yeah.
It's been a year and a bit.
And she kept on saying, are you sure? And I was like, yeah.
I just need 60 days.
Sit down and write. And like you said, it is the most excruciating time of your life. You doubt yourself, you doubt your ability to write, you're isolated, you don't go out. And when she sit, like Tabiso can sit on your back, hey? She can sit on your back. She said, you promised me this manuscript.
Where is it?
Where is it? So so I actually decided to write when she asked me to write. And I think it was the most amazing process, as excruciating as it was the most amazing process because I learned so much actually through writing the book. And it's a very apt book, by the way. It's a book for such a time as this, if I have to say so myself.
In fact, part of the reason why I thought, you know, this is a conversation we must have is I think given the conversation over the last 2 weeks, which many of us have been having for many years, like Prof. Dineo Gola was saying, we've been having this conversation about why violence against women and children and men and boys happens, you know, that it is a crisis, that it is, you know, as serious as we now seem to appreciate.
Yeah.
So just, you know, and thinking about that, I thought, well, in fact, this is the book for the current times.
Sure.
And when you wrote it, did you anticipate that your book would be so timely?
I was actually scared because I come from a very conservative Christian background.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in a very patriarchal society.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we get called out all the time on Twitter, on Facebook. And here I was writing a book, a nonfiction book. And throughout writing this book, I kept on saying, no wonder people write fiction, because you can hide a lot behind creating stories. But here I'm writing nonfiction and I'm making claims, you know, that people will keep me accountable for. Mm. So I was scared. I thought to myself, I don't know if I'm going to deal with the backlash, because simply as you said, I write about my journey as a feminist, my journey with patriarchy, and maybe we can unpack some few things. But I didn't know that I was writing it for any time. I actually thought this book would not be accepted in society. I mean, mm-hmm. I actually don't know if it's going to be accepted because it just came out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm still scared. I'm nervous about what I wrote. Mm-hmm. But I think it is a conversation that when I was writing it, as I said, I was learning so much about myself, so much about society as well. Because there's one thing to know theory like feminist theory because you're living it. But there's another thing to actually use it to look at your life and reflect on your life and try to explain it in the most simplest way. Mm-hmm. Because actually in the book itself, although I write about my feminist journey, I don't mention the word feminism until the last chapter, because for two reasons. The first reason is because feminism has become an F-bomb. You know, uh-huh. When you say I'm a feminist, people associate you with all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Or it's used as an insult. As you're one of those exactly. Feminists.
Feminism, it's Africa Day, and it's like feminism is un-African. So I actually
which
wanted,
is a lie. There are centuries
listen,
of...
So I wanted.
I mean, yeah.
No, I'm agreeing with you, and I say, listen. Mm. So I wanted to actually just use the theory and use my life to show how feminist theory is applicable in our everyday experiences. And because I come from a very conservative Christian background, and if you know anything about a conservative Christian background, you know that it keeps up the order of patriarchy on another level. Mm-hmm. And coming out of that to finding my own autonomy, to saying that I want to have my own voice, is actually, you know, it's a big thing. It's a big thing because it's like you're going out of your identity and you stand a backlash from society to say this is what a woman needs to be, but here you're making these decisions. So this is why this book was so important for me when I was writing it.
19 minutes after 11, it is the Literature Corner for this week, joined in studio by Malebo Sipodi, the author of Misbehave, and speaking about, I guess, finding your voice, finding your autonomy, but also taking complicated, dense, very academic ideas like feminism, particularly intersectional feminism, and writing simply. Because I guess one of the big questions, I know I have this all the time, is what is the point of all of this great knowledge and scholarship and work if it can only be accessed through universities or through, you know, knowing, you know, how to speak like bell hooks, or you know, in many ways it's very inaccessible.
Yeah.
But what is the point of knowledge if it can't be accessed? And so we're discussing some of that with Malebo and taking your calls on 021-446-0567 as well as 011-883-0702. You can send us your SMSs on 31702 and 31567.
702 and Cape Talk, the Literature Corner.
22 minutes after 11. Welcome back to the Sibus Makhaza Show with me, Gugs Mhlongo. And welcome back to the Literature Corner for this week. Speaking to Malebo Sipodi, the author of Misbehave, a book published by Blackbird Books, an imprint of Jacana. And Malebo, as we were chatting off air, you were saying part of the process of this book was inserting yourself.
Yeah.
So saying I, which you try to avoid.
Yeah, the first draft was very detached from me because I tried to explain things very academically. You know, for example, in chapter three is about the dear black man, and I talk about my journey with violent masculinities because I've done quite a lot of work with men in prison and mentorship, etc. Mm-hmm. So in that chapter, for example, I was writing about stats and all the work that I have done and the observations that that I've been part of, but I wasn't writing about my experiences and what I think. And and when it came to the editing process, the editor kept on saying, "You refer to yourself in the third person. Mm-hmm. I want you to
like the queen.
Yeah,
one." Or the editors,
one
what is
tends
it called?
To,
yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
know. And then she's like, "I want you to put yourself in it. Even Tabiso, my publisher, kept on saying it. I want you to put yourself in it. I want when they read this book, they should get to know you, Malebo. Mm. Not the thinker, not the knowledgeable person, but your experiences. Mm. And hence it became a totally different experience for me when I had to now insert myself, because then I started to think about things in a way that I'd never thought about. Because you know, in academia we get taught to critically analyze, to look at all angles, to find all the literature that backs things up. But with experience, you know, there's nothing that backs your experience. It's your experience. Mm. You know, no one can discount your experience.
It's my lived experience.
So if you say I saw this, or I experienced this, or I felt this, no one can say no, you didn't, because mm-hmm. this is what I'm saying. So it was quite interesting. And once I started putting myself in, I couldn't stop.
Really?
Yeah. So literally, some people might say it's vanity, but I think it works. The fact that I've actually just tracked, it's actually tracking my journey from a time where I used to think patriarchy was normal, where I used to justify patriarchy. Mm-hmm. I used to justify the notion that the man is the head and the woman is the neck.
That turns the head.
The
bone patriarchy throws you. You're not the head, but you know, turn the
yeah,
head.
Yeah, without the head. I mean, without the neck, the head can't survive. Mm. And then when I used to be the person that used to justify male violence, you know, mm-hmm. because there's lots of theories of why men are violent, you know. And you actually, when you're in that world, we live in a world that teaches you to put men first, to justify men's actions, but to never reflect on yourself. You know, so for example, there's a part in the book where I write about how I started an organization in 2005 for women, for abused women and mm-hmm. children, right? And so I used to hear stories every single day. And there's a part in the book where I talk about when I encountered a story of a lesbian being killed in Soweto. Mm-hmm. And these were the kind of cases that we dealt with. So every single day we were counseling women and those who were sexually marginalized every single day. And we were encountering the violence, you know, that they were living with. Mm. And for me, every time you spoke to these people, you found that at the center of the pain lied men, like it was men, mm. you know. And so then I went into maximum prison, like maximum correctional centers, to work with men to try and understand why men were violent. So we live in a world that we go out of our way to try and understand why men are violent. Let's help the men, you know, women, change your behavior so that men stop being violent. Oh, mm-hmm. society is creating violent men. Maybe society must change. Mm-hmm. But we never actually hold the perpetrators accountable. And so I tracked that journey of my life with violent masculinities, when I used to make excuses. And these are the excuses that we see every single day. You know, the notions of the not all men are, you know, that rapists look like this and criminals look like this, but they're a special group of men that don't look like this. So don't group all men. Mm-hmm. So I explain that journey and I problematize why this not all men notion is problematic, and also how men should start looking at this whole notion of violent masculinities. So in that chapter, the dear black men, you know, in that chapter, I speak about why a time I lived when I used to make excuses for men, and now where I am, where I'm actually holding them accountable, mm. you know. And the book is not really written for men. I'm not interested in men reading this book. The book is written for black women, and mostly black women that are struggling with autonomy, black women that are questioning, black women that because a lot of people will say, oh, yes, you say men are trash, but who raises these men, you know? Mm-hmm. Or it's at the end of the day, it's always women who are supporting these men. Mm-hmm. I mean, remember Reverend or Pastor Omar Toso, mm-hmm. who did hideous crime against some church people, and women showed up for him. Mm-hmm. I explain why that women happens. Would show up for rapists, etc. I explain things like internal oppression. You know, I explain how we conditioned to view patriarchy as the norm, and how we can begin deconstructing it. So the reason I wrote it was for black women, and if black men want to read it, they will benefit from it highly. if they can remove their not all men.
Fragility.
Exactly.
So now, okay, so you speak about part of where this starts is your journey starts at home, because home is quite conservative.
Yep. Yep.
Home is quite patriarchal. Now, how do you have this conversation with your family? Because at some point, I'm sure you have to say, I'm writing, so I'm about to publish. I'm also publishing about this thing, which we consider to be normal, but is actually quite dangerous and quite violent and put so many of us in harm's way. But also about, I imagine you can't do that without speaking about home and speaking about the people in that home. So how do you have the conversation that, guys, heads up, this thing is happening, and I discuss myself, and I can't discuss myself
without you.
Without you.
Yeah. It's actually quite fascinating that you say that, because a big part of my conditioning happened in the church, right? So, for example, my dad is quite an open-minded person, my biological dad. Mm-hmm. But I didn't grow up with him. And then my mom is very conservative, but she... Before, you know, she also went through a journey where it was the other way around, you know. She was very, she was an activist, you know, and then she went through a journey where she became a pastor. So I saw that, so as a child, I know it's complicated, but it makes more sense in the book. So as a child, I detail my journey with the church mostly, because that's where I spent my time 24/7. And people who are dedicated to occults and churches will agree that you give your life and everything revolves around the church. So I explain about the conditioning that takes place and why we think a certain way and why we believe in certain things that we believe in, and how certain values within the family. So I also speak about when I grew up with my grandparents in rural Sikha, the things that I saw around that actually added to how we viewed sexuality as in binary terms, or how we viewed the world where men are the head of the, of the household. So I write about that in detail. And but because already my family had been seeing this journey of mine, because when you've been a very faithful church girl and then one day you stop going to church, not that I've given my faith up, but one day you start questioning everything. It disrupts the family, you know.
It
almost killed my relationship with my mom, because she was like, some demons are taking over in your life. And I was like, you know what? Allow me to go through this journey. And so because they had already seen my life unravel in that way, they were kind of prepared when they heard that I'm writing a book. And so all I said to my mom is, I'm going to write a book, and your church people are going to call you for an all-night prayer to pray for deliverance for my label. And she was like, yeah, it's okay. But every single day I started telling her about the things that I was writing in the book. And funny enough, Gugu, she started seeing them. She started saying, oh, you know, patriarchy is real. And she started, now she calls me and she says, this happened. So I think it's actually quite interesting that the thing that, because I detail my journey, that when people read the book, especially if they relate, they will relate on a level that, okay, fine, we relate with this, but maybe we are questioning, or maybe we are about to question. So that's, I think that's where it becomes important for dealing with that, you know, with that thin line.
Okay, we'll continue that conversation. Yeah. Still joined in studio by author of Misbehave, Malebo Sepodi, for the Literature Corner this week.
702 and Cape Talk. The Literature Corner.
24 minutes before midday. You're still on the Eusebius Makhaza Show with me, Gugs Mhlungu, with you until noon, and still discussing Misbehave by Malebo Sepodi, who joins me in studio this morning. Coming up in a few minutes' time, we'll be discussing a book which I think is quite apt for Africa Day. Greg Mills has worked on a book with former Nigerian President Obasanjo, which looks at the challenges of post-colonial Africa and what some of those challenges are, but also how they can be solved. It's called Making Africa Work. And it's really, and I think refreshingly, a how rather than a what is the problem. It looks at how we can solve them. And we'll be speaking to Greg Mills shortly. But Malebo, the title of the book, I mean, we've spoken about everything but the title.
Yeah.
Why is it called Misbehaving? I mean, it's a play on misbehaving, but also miss as a title.
It's because when I came across, it's been inspired by a quote by a historian, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, and she says, well-behaved women seldom make history. Mm-hmm. And that's a quote that I've kind of appropriated, and I appropriated for various reasons that I explain in the book, that I've appropriated in my life, and I've used it to say, actually, there's an idea of what it means to be a well-behaved Black woman. Mm-hmm. And we grow up with that. You know, we've spoken about how we get conditioned, how we expected to dress, how we expected to behave. So there's a notion that if you sit there, you know, and the notion of being ladylike, etc., is being a well-behaved woman. And if you do certain things that go out of societal status quo, then you are misbehaving. And I've lived like that. I was like, I'm disrupting status quo. I'm smashing patriarchy, and I'm going to misbehave while I'm at it. And you know that as a man, your prefix is Mr., right? They call you Mr. Whether you're married or you're not, you're single, you are Mr. When you're a woman, you have Miss and Mrs. And then you do have the Ms., the M with the small S. But mainly, people will address you as Miss if you are not married and Mrs. if you are married. So I played on that word, like misbehave. Mm. So I was a Miss who behaved a lot and took a journey to misbehavior. So does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Makes complete sense. And I agree. I believe in misbehaving.
Yeah, yeah.
So someone asking the question, let me see if I can find it. So firstly, Rufilo saying, hearing Malebo speak makes me want to buy, I just want to read her book. She sounds brilliant. And I respect you a great deal for publishing. I think publishing is so scary.
Sure.
It's terrifying. I was speaking I saw someone a couple of weeks ago and they said, you know, how's the book coming along? I said, which one? And they're like, oh well, whatever, whichever one.
Yeah.
And she said, why won't you publish? And I said, I'm scared. And,
yeah.
and he took me in his arms and he's published quite a few books and he said, publishing is terrifying. It is one of the scariest things in the world, but you must do it anyway.
It's scary because I've had like nervous breakdowns while writing, while editing, and while it's coming out. So I agree. And I'm still scared.
Terrifying.
This is a front. I'm still scared.
This is a front. So someone's saying, your guest talks about men reading that book as optional. One would have thought that you would highly recommend that men read it, given, you know, what it deals with. So I guess the question about, you know, if men read it, that's cool, but it's not importantly or critically for them is the question. Surely it should be prescribed reading, necessary reading for men.
Cooks, you know, we women prescribe and we teach and we help and we show all the time. We have to explain ourselves, right, to men. And the thing is, I'd love them to read it and to prescribe it and to recommend it to each other. This is what I want. I want accountability from men, because one thing that I have stopped doing in my life, I've stopped trying to show men my pain. I've stopped trying to teach men. My loyalty lies with women and those who continually to be sexually marginalized, right? And so, and those who do not fit in the prescribed notion of what it means to be a masculine man. So,
a manly man.
You're a manly man. So my loyalty lies with actually having a conversation about how can we be there for each other. And this book simply just tracks my journey. I'm not trying to force anything to anyone, but I'm saying, let's have a conversation. And it also would be very important for men to read, because then they would understand. Then they would get the idea of why the not all men notion is incorrect. Then they will understand why is it that the world continuously, for example, looks at the girl child more than the world looks at the boy child. They'll understand all those notions. They'll understand why it is that we are making this noise. But it is up to them to take that step. I was actually saying there were the men that planned the march. What is it called? Not in my name march.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they should get this copy and they should read this copy and they should recommend it to their fellow men. It's very, very important in that way. But I didn't write it for men. But I think that men would benefit if they read it. Does that make sense? But yes. I didn't write it for men.
Makes complete sense.
Yeah.
We have Buhlale in Pretoria. Buhlale, good morning.
Morning, Gugu. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I'm good. My level. Hey, babe.
Hi, Buhlale.
Gugu, I just really wanted to make a comment. My level is a good sister of mine. And congratulations on finishing the book. I know that it's been a very grueling journey for you.
Thank you.
I think one of the things I respect about you, and I'm not just saying this because I love you, is your ability to construct very intelligent arguments. You know, you always identify something in society, and you don't just go with a popular view. You're able to really, really engage critically with content and to make it come alive. So congratulations, and I wish you all the best with the book.
Thank you so much. Please send me a selfie with the book.
Cool, too. I'll buy a couple, actually, for
Thank
all the
so
women
much.
I love.
Thank you, Bohlale. Right. Thank okay. you. Okay. Cheers.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's Bohlale in Pretoria. So, Malebo, that brings an end to our chat. Aww. Thank you very much for coming in. I'm very excited to read this book. Now that I have a manuscript in the works, I have a little bit more time.
Sure.
Well,
please read the book.
I will. And I think it's a very important one. And I'm very glad you've published this book. Congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. And just as a plea, I'm just a black woman wanting to be a bestseller. Please, just a plea.
I just want to be number one.
I don't want, you know, I don't even have to be number one. I just have to be a bestseller, because we can all be bestseller at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So please just go out and buy the book. It's Misbehave. And when you buy it, just write about it. Give me a review. Go on Twitter and use the hashtag MISSBEHAVE. If I don't type myself up, who's going to hype me up?
No, you must hype yourself up. It's very important.
In these days where we allow men to be mediocre and flourish, I want to be mediocre and flourish.
But you're not mediocre, really, though. Thank you very much. That's Malebo Sipodi joining us this morning. When we come back, speaking about making Africa work, which seems like a timely question on Africa Day, and we'll be speaking to the head of the Brenthurst Foundation, Greg Mills.
702 and Cape Talk, the Literature Corner.
13 minutes before midday, 13 minutes before we wrap up the show and make way for the Midday Report, where you won't miss a thing. Having a special Literature Corner for this week and looking at two books. So we've just spoken to the author of Misbehave, Malebo Sipodi. Now speaking to the head of the Brenthurst Foundation, Greg Mills, who co-authored former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo's book called How Making Africa Work. And he was recently speaking about it, saying governing parties like the ANC will have to be given a fight for its money before it fixed itself. And he said this is a good thing, saying it's actually a good thing where big parties, governing parties, are kept on their toes and made to essentially work for the mandate from the electorate. And he was also speaking about issues of governance and management and confidence in the economy. So to tell us more about this book, which I'm quite excited to read, Making Africa Work, the head of the Brenthurst Foundation, Greg Mills. Greg, thank you so much for making time for us this morning.
Good morning, Gogs.
So many a time we have lots of books that articulate the what of Africa's problems. We know, you know, many of books have been written about them. And what I found interesting about a lot of the reviews about this book is it moves away from what and deals with how. And I mean, a previous book as well, which you had written, is Why States Recover. So almost moving away from the articulation of our problems to saying, well, this is what we know in terms of solutions, in terms of answers, and what we can use to move the continent forward. Is that deliberate on your part? So moving away from describing our problems, but saying, well, we know what they are. This is how we can start addressing them.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The work of the Brenthurst Foundation is ostensibly to work with governments at their request in devising solutions to problems. And we've been in existence for a little over a decade, and we've learned many lessons along the way. We'd be blind to those lessons if we didn't reflect that. And, you know, some things we've done right and some things we've not got right. And what this book is trying to do is to take those lessons of the last decade or a bit more than that and try and put them in 300 pages and not just describe, as indeed I've done in other books, what the problems are. It's actually about describing what the solutions look like and how you, as you correctly term it, and how you can actually go about putting them into place. And I think one of the great strengths of the book is actually in the in the combined authorship. You know, being a shared author or co-author is never an easy job. You have to really get along with your co-authors. And having President Obasanjo, who's the chairman of the foundation, as part of the writing team, has really infused it with a real sense of the politically possible and how you go around managing difficult circumstances, because indeed economic reform is all about politics at the end of the day. And then my two other co-authors, one of whom is a retired British general who's an expert in planning as an engineer. And so he comes at these issues from a different perspective. And then my longtime collaborator, Jeffrey Herbst, who's a very renowned Africanist based in the United States. And together we've sort of gelled as a team, very much under the leadership of President Obasanjo, in writing about the how. And that's been great fun, not just writing about the problems and getting morose and depressed about them, but actually writing about how we can solve them. Because there is this tremendous challenge / opportunity out there, which is Sub-Saharan Africa's population is going to go from 1 billion today to 2 billion by 2050. Mm-hmm. And if it continues to grow at that rate, it again double by the turn of the next century. And about 80% of that increase is going to be in our cities. So it presents a tremendous challenge to putting the right conditions, policy, infrastructure, and all that in place, but also a tremendous opportunity if we get things right, this concentrated energy of people, young people connected to the world. So it is a book with a positive vision and message and seeing how we can actually turn things around for the better.
One of the reviews of the book was from former President Joyce Banda, saying, "I wish I'd had this handbook when I was president of Malawi." Also hearing from Donald Kebruka, the ex-president of the African Development Bank, saying, you know, there's a blueprint to a prosperous Africa. And someone might say, or a cynic might say, you know, where are these solutions? Why haven't we implemented them before? Where are they coming from? Why are we finding them now? What makes this book different to perhaps the reams and reams of research, of interventions that we've seen in the past? What makes this book different?
Yeah, I think two things make it different. I mean, it's very kind of them to write that. It's probably not a blueprint because, of course, there's 55 countries in Africa and each one has different strengths and weaknesses. And so it is a search for sort of common threads. So, if you implement different things in different ways for different countries, you may well come up with some of the solutions. But so we try and it's more of almost a guide to action. But I guess it's different in a couple of respects. One is, we've had a lot of experience working in the continent, and we're trying to put this all down on paper. So, and some things have worked and some things have failed. And I think, the second aspect is the foundation's role has been to try and identify best practice from around the world, including in Africa. So a lot of the book is infused with personal, maybe even anecdotal, but personal analytical experiences of working in different places, everywhere from Colombia to Singapore, Vietnam to Costa Rica, and understanding, you know, what worked elsewhere and how this might be applied to the specific circumstances of Africa. So there's two things. One is we're aware of what it's like working on the ground, and secondly, we're aware of what's worked elsewhere and can we actually match this? And the book is about that matching process.
And who is this book for? It sounds as though it's for people with some kind of access to the levers of power, so mayors, ministers, DGs, etc., so people who can quite literally make Africa work. But I would imagine they would be the one core audience, but who is this for as well? Is it, is it dense policy talk that I as a normal person wouldn't be able to access, or is it about speaking about some of the challenges and solutions in very simple, accessible ways?
You know, they say the art of genius or ability is taking difficult things and making them easy to understand, but the reverse also holds true. Mm. So hopefully we've made these things easy to understand. Yes, it is a policy-minded audience that we have in mind, but we've actually had almost the most fun in the last week because we did a week of book launches in South Africa, culminating at the Literary Festival at Franschhoek on Saturday. And the most fun was actually speaking to school kids, because it's actually a book for the next generation. And, you know, in a sense, we're setting them up to think about these challenges in a constructive way. And I have to say, President Obasanjo was just brilliant at articulating this, telling his own story from a third person who went to school for the first time, age 11, and his career path to the school kids. And, you know, when these challenges come about, they're going to be in the, you know, in the seats of power with their hands on the levers and fingers on the buttons, and they're the ones who need to be empowered. So it's not just about today's decision makers, it's also about tomorrow's. And what we would like to see this is as a book that people engage with. They can spit out the ideas if they don't like them, but they can start thinking about this mega challenge and mega opportunity in a constructive way.
That's Greg Mills, the co-author of Making Africa Work, a new book which I think is necessary reading, co-authored with former Nigerian president Olusegun Obasanjo, and I think it's one to pick up. And thank you very much for your time this morning, Greg.
Thanks, Greg. Nice to chat to you.
Thank you very much. That's the head of the Brenthurst Foundation, Greg Mills.